You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
Hey, everybody. Sorry for being a bit late, and welcome to another episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. This week is a very important week. A lot of crazy stuff going on in the world, very sensitive. And I wanted to address it with a teammate, former teammate of mine, Joe Kelly, that I'm excited to talk about. Really, Black Lives Matter. It's important. And, you know, I'm certainly not an expert on any of this, and Joe's going to help bring some and shed some light. As always, if anybody wants to see and find out what's going on with me, you can go to my website, www.markpattisonnfl.com. I've got Everest that's been pushed out 1 year, so I'm training again back in Sun Valley. This is a live broadcast. I'm so jacked to be back here, hardcore training like we used to do back in the day. And also we've got a new campaign called the Everest, Amelia's Everest, the Losi Challenge. And so there's a lot behind that, but we've already raised $2,000, trying to raise another $27,940, which is the height of Losi, which will be included in that package next year with Mount Everest. Okay, on that note, I want to bring in my former teammate, great guy, all-star football player, Joe Kelly. Joe, how you doing?
Oh, can't complain, Mark, man. Life is going good, man. We're in some, we're at a critical time, man, in America. It's a lot of things going on, but, I'm blessed to be here, blessed to be in the situation that, I'm personally in. But, there's a lot of things going on throughout the world, specifically a lot of things are going on with the African-American community, and police brutality. And, it's a really sensitive subject, but, I really appreciate, you reaching out to me and, so we can have some dialogue. And I think more than anything, we're all in this together. It's just not the African-American community all the way back with civil rights. We weren't able to make the gains that we did just because of us. You have had a lot of great people, a lot of non-African-American, non-people of color who helped us get there. And I just believe that, there are too many good people. And like, just being an athlete, it's a great microcosm of life. You go to college, and we all come from a thousand different backgrounds and different religions, and when you get there and you have that locker room, you're talking about here guys have never been around white guys never been around Black guys or Samoan guys or whatever, and we are as close as some of our actual blood families. And even to this day, coming to University of Washington in 1982, some of my closest friends are from the University of Washington. And I was in University of Washington 82, 3, 4, and 5. And it's 2020. And to this day, my closest and some of the best people I know are from the University of Washington.
So let's stay on that for just a minute. Going back, that's how I met you. So we were both recruited. You were recruited out of South Central LA. You went to Thomas Jefferson High School. I went to Roosevelt High School, which is the big Seattle school in there. So other players that also were teammates were Kent McKinney and others. So, it was definitely, mixed for me. But there was nothing better than having that team in that day, in that era. I think Don James did a phenomenal job of really aggregating, all this talent from all over the country, mainly up and down the West Coast, but bringing that in. And then where we really brought it all together, every year was very successful for us. But in that my senior year, your junior year, I can't think of three linebackers that were more just ferocious and intimidating, led the Purple Rain defense, Joe Kelly, Joe Kukowski, and Tim Yamber. And then he had a bunch of other just monsters in the secondary, JR, Jimmy Rogers, Vesty Jackson, Ron Miles, JC Pearson, those other guys, right? They were just Tim Peoples, great players. Yeah, so just finishing that thought, and I want to give some context for anybody who doesn't know your background, but you were one of the stars on the team. You were one of the guys that helped us win that Orange Bowl. Should have been number one, ended up number two. You ended up playing another year, but you were, you know, one of those guys that were picked number one in the NFL draft to the Cincinnati Bengals, and you went on to have a very successful 11-year NFL career. So congrats to you. You and I haven't chatted in a long time.
Yeah.
I want to bring up something really quickly. As you know, being you and I are in the NFL family as well now, and part of that, you and I get these quotes every Friday from the Trust. And something that I was going back and looking at this, I got to put my glasses on to actually read this stuff, but it's longtime civil rights activist Dick Gregory said that, quote, "This isn't a revolution of black against white. This is a revolution of right against wrong." And I thought that was a really interesting way of positioning that. And I'm no expert here, Joe, at all. And that's why I wanted to bring you on. And I don't know what it's like to be black, and you don't know what it's like to be white, because that's not what we represent. But I wanted to give you a platform to give a black voice on what's going on, and really from how can we improve, right? And how do we put this thing back together?
Yeah. So, you know, Mark, like I said, again, appreciate you having me on because it's such a crucial time and for America. And, you know, it's very touchy subject when it comes to discussing what we as black Americans have been dealing with, and what our ancestors have dealt with. And we're talking about here, this isn't new. This isn't something that's new for the African-American community. It's just now that it's being taped. And if we can go to what half of America thought was very controversial with Colin Kaepernick taking a knee, we as African-Americans understood it was never about the flag. You know, and that's a discussion that needs to be had as well, because it wasn't about disrespecting the flag, disrespecting the national anthem. His focus was on what you've seen in Minneapolis 7 days ago with Mr. Floyd. When we're talking about the things that we as African Americans deal with, regardless of your financial status, because you're still, when you walk out of that door, you're black. When you come out of that locker room, you're black. When you cash that $1 million check, you're black. And the thing is to try and get to an understanding of what we're trying to say. And me, myself personally, growing up in South Central Los Angeles and Pacoima, California, in my own neighborhoods, I didn't really have that problem growing up, but it wasn't until I got to the NFL and I was making money that I started personally dealing with being racially profiled, being stopped and not given a ticket, but having a gun put to my head. That happened to me 6-7 times. Never got a ticket, but I fit the description. So when we talk about that, regardless of what Mr. Floyd did 10 minutes prior to the video, for 9 minutes that the police had his knee on his neck and basically murdered the guy. But this is not anything new to us. And if you see now, and I think right now, I'm really excited about what I see, because, you know, they are protesting in South Dakota. They're protesting in Australia. You know, so this has become this has gone global with the people noticing the plight of the African American community and what we've been saying that's been happening. But it just doesn't, it's not, and we can go, we're not, we've never said, when we talk about Black Lives Matter, we've never said, you know, that white lives didn't matter, all lives, but we're not talking about that, because when you walk out the door, you know, you're not African-American, you know, we are. So we're trying to get to a point where we're saying, hey, you know, these are the kind of things that we deal with being Black that you wouldn't have to deal with just because of the color of your skin. But it just didn't start with the police police department. You know, you're talking about the socioeconomic status. You know, you're talking about years of oppression. You know, you're talking about things of, you know, the justice system. So here, it was great that in our opinion that those four cops were charged. But like I said, I made a post. It wasn't about that. What it's about is, you know, once it goes to the judicial system, if those guys actually get convicted of that and not get off. You know, you have, you know, some people who don't understand and saying, well, hey, why doesn't the African-American community, why aren't they protesting about Black on Black crime? Well, we do. You look in and you go through every area in the United States that is predominantly African-American, you can see Stop the Violence, parades, movements. It just doesn't get covered, you know, like this has been covered. So, you know, we just want to make and bring, you know, awareness to what the African-American community has been going through forever. You know, it didn't start with our generation. You know, it started, you know, when you know, slavery, when the slaves were freed, you know, and once they were freed, they weren't allowed to own property. They weren't allowed to read. They weren't allowed to do all these things. So how could they go up the socioeconomic ladder? And, you know, do, you know, a lot of people are talking about the violence. You know, the protesting and the looting and violence, we don't condone all that. But I understand. I won't say I don't understand, because you have, when you talk about, you know, the plight of the African American, when you talk about the neighborhoods, when you're talking about banks redlining and not loaning people money to buy those houses in those areas. So, you know, for a generation, you know, when you talk about generational wealth, you know, African American community has never been really allowed to, for years, to be able to put in that category, because they initially weren't even allowed to own homes. Then the banks wouldn't allow them to, they wouldn't loan money to them so they can buy the homes. You know, they started business. They couldn't get loans to start businesses. So, you know, you always stayed, you know, to a point where you were always below the poverty level. So, you know, it Mark, we can go back on, you know, where it begins and how to this day, the social injustice is so unfair, because you have a Caucasian guy get charged with murder. They just say it was murder. And they go to jail for 7 years and get out. And then the same guy, African-American guy, committed the same exact crime, and he gets 30 years. You know, so you know, it starts there. But, you know, I am, in my opinion, what I see, this is, because I can sit here and have a list of names, and Mark, I can give you names for hours of all the, you know, the African Americans who have died at the hands of police. You know, you go back to Emmett Till, you know, for whistling, you know, at a Caucasian woman and got hung, got beat, got tortured. We can go back to you know, the some of the small things that, you know, African Americans got hung for. They wanted to vote. So hey, they got hung for that. You know, Reed, they got hung for that. You know, so we can really get so deep into a lot of the violence, you know, was created by, you know, the Europeans. You know, Europeans came here and pillaged the Native Americans. You know, Europeans were hanging us, you know, beating us. And the I understand here when you have someone say, well, hey, that was that generation. That wasn't us. No, it was. It was. But we are still suffering to this day at the hands of what happened, what your ancestors did to all African Americans. And it starts with the socioeconomic status. You know, if you're by, you know, the justice system is not broke. So let's get that. The justice system is not broke. The justice system is working exactly how it was meant to be, to keep us inferior, to keep us in positions where we couldn't grow. It was always injustices. You have a lawyer, I can't recall his name, but he grew up in Philadelphia. It's a movie out with his name. I can't recall his name right now, but he's gotten 190 people off of death row, African Americans off of death row.
Yeah, I saw that movie. Incredible movie.
Yes. So, you know, how does that happen? That's like now. I'm not talking about in the future. I'm talking about now. How does that happen? How can a judicial system, a federal judicial system, be set up where you can have that many people, that just him? We're just talking about him. So if he can get overturned 190 death row cases, you know, we're just scratching at the surface.
Let me jump in for a minute, Joe. So, you know, first of all, I got to tell you, you're extremely well spoken and you're very clear and concise on what you're trying to communicate and articulate. You know, let's start with the first thing you were talking about, Mr. Floyd. You know, it's just disgusting what those cops did. And, you know, it just makes me sick to my stomach that, you know, somebody who's white is doing that, you know, blatantly. There's a video camera. People are yelling at him to get off and he didn't, you know. I also think that is part of the healing, you know, when we go back. And I want to bring up a name that we, you know, that used to be a teammate of ours. And unfortunately, he passed away tragically in a auto accident. But Fred Smalley, linebacker, another guy out of South L.A., I believe. I know he's very tight with Jimmy Mora. And he one time, you know, now this is he'd been on the team for a couple of years. And, you know, as we were all developing in the system, the Don James way, pyramid of success.
Yes.
He came up to me and he said, it was a really interesting conversation. He goes, you know what? My high school, I've never played or gone to school with one white guy. And, mm-hmm. and there was all these talented white guys on the team, right? Steve Puller mm-hmm. and Hugh Millen and Rick Finney and Jimmy Rogers and Jimmy Mora. And there's a whole slew of them, Steve Alford. Mm-hmm. And he said, I honestly thought that black people were superior athletically than white. And being here, being at the University of Washington, I've learned, and he was talking about me and the other guys, I've learned that, you know, white guys can be just as talented as black guys. You know, it just doesn't matter. Yeah. And the whole point with that is that of coming together rather than put it, you know, one group over here and one group over there, it's coming together and interacting. And so we're getting to know each other. And this sign right, you know, behind me, where that's where that brotherly love, yeah. you know, starts to really kick in. I mean, there's no way in a million years that obviously we're all super talented, but mm-hmm. if we didn't have that common goal and we didn't come together and hold hands in a way yeah. that there is no racism and there weren't any color barriers or anything that we can have done, you know, what we did. Joe, I want to bring in another former teammate right now. And the reason why I had asked Jim Moore to come on a podcast is not only is he a friend of yours, but Jim is a guy who coached in the NFL for 25 years, coached a lot of African-American kids, and also the last 6 years at UCLA and all the times that he was in these inner city homes and dealing, you know, with all the craziness and the disparity you were talking about before in wealth and where that's gone. So, Jim, I want to bring you in, invite you. Thanks for joining us again. And what are your thoughts about what's going on and especially some of the articulate things that Joe has said?
Well, first of all, Joe, it's great to see you again. And I appreciate and admire your passion. And I can tell that it is from the heart, as I understand that it would be. And and rest in peace, Freddie Small, who I've got goosebumps right now talking about Freddie because we had a special bond. We would room together on the road and he called me Opie.
And he told me, I remember that.
You know, I was a backup and I was never going to play. Heck, the only time I ever got to go in a game, I think, as a linebacker was against Michigan when Freddie got hurt and Skip Hall looked at me like, oh my God, I got to put you in, you know, bill number five, which is one of my favorite numbers anyway, because Kenny Easley, who was a hero of mine growing up as well. But, you know, may he rest in peace. And I think, you know, we he opened my eyes to a lot of things. I was very fortunate to grow up the son of a football coach who recruited, you know, LA, and had experiences that maybe a lot of fathers didn't have. They were able to pass on to me. And saying that, I want to acknowledge that at only a fraction did I ever understand what it truly meant to live a life as a Black man or a Black person as opposed to a white person. But, you know, being with Freddie was just, it was very, very, very good for me.
Transparent.
Yeah, you've said a few things that I'd love to just expand on and talk to you about. And I think you said it's a critical time in America and really out throughout the world. And it is so critical. And I think that what's so important, and I want to hear your thoughts, is that how we capture this moment. You know, I think people use the words protest, and they use the words revolution, and they use the words demonstration. And I would love to see those words eventually transform into the word rally, because I think rally is a word that intimates momentum. And if in a week or two this all just kind of goes away, then what did we gain? And I think that I think we also have to be careful about the word healing. It's healing will eventually come, but I think the scab needs to stay, or the wound needs to stay open and not scab over yet. And I think the wound needs to be on the arm of the whites, and not on the arm of the Black man or woman. I say man, and when I say man, I say that including all people of color. But the scab needs to be on the arm of the white man, the white woman, and not the African-American. You know, you said that, you know, they're protesting, they're demonstrating, they're rallying in places like South Dakota. As I was driving back to my house today to do this talk with you and Mark, I drove by a place in Redondo Beach, which is, you know, I mean, it's not the most affluent area, but it's, you know, there's some affluence there. And I was driving up to Palos Verdes, which is an area of affluence. And I saw people of all colors and all ages standing in parks and standing at intersections with signs, young people, you know, 5, 6, 7 years old, old people with signs, and peacefully protesting, demonstrating, or what I, in the word rally came to my mind when I turned the corner. I saw that because I said, they're not protesting, they're rallying. They're trying to invoke change. Mm-hmm. And Joe, I want to ask you, from your opinion, how can Mark, how can the people that we are around that don't have an exposure to being in a locker room, you know, with men like you or Freddie or Timmy Peoples or, you know, all the other wonderful people around, how do we continue to make sure that there's a light shining on this? You know, it was only 4 years ago that Colin Kaepernick, as you said, he took a knee.
Yeah.
Not because he was disrespecting the flag. He took a knee because he was making a statement about police brutality,
yes,
and racial oppression.
Yes.
And,
yes.
You know, and I know I'm going to give you a chance to talk here. I just have so much on my mind. I want to get out. I thought something really interesting happened in the last 24 hours and it regarding Drew Brees.
Drew Brees. Yeah.
So I know Drew Brees well, and I will say this with conviction. He's a good man.
I know he is.
And he, I believe, is socially aware. And in a very odd way, the mistake that he made, the ignorance he displayed in not acknowledging why people were taking a knee on Sundays or Thursdays or Fridays or Mondays now, all the games are played, I hope opened the eyes of those that were ignorant to why Colin Kaepernick and Eric Reed started that movement. And I know Drew made a heartfelt apology today, and I saw where, you know, his receiver, you know, his great receiver, Michael Thomas, acknowledged it and accepted his apology. So in a weird way, maybe that will help. But how do we, Joe, how do we, me, Mark, us, you, how do we keep this alive? How do we make the progress that we fool ourselves into thinking we've made? Look, I took my team to the Civil Rights Museum in Memphis when we were playing Memphis State 2 years ago. Mark, I don't know if you were with us, but and it was great and it was compelling and it was touching. But then it dissipates. We can't let it dissipate, Joe.
Yeah, you can't. So when you hit a couple, there's a lot of great points, Jimmy. first is acknowledgement, because you have half of America still referring to Colin Kaepernick that it was he was disrespecting the flag and disrespecting, you know, our veterans, which was absolutely not it. And first you have to understand that in order to try and get what we're talking about. So they also made the argument with, you know, what does Colin Kaepernick know about police brutality and social injustice? He's a millionaire, you know. And so now, but what you see now, what is going on right now? See, right now, this thing is galvanized. And I don't think, you know, even with the civil rights movement, we had pockets of United States city. There's countries. We have countries right now, and you have 50% of the people out there protesting are Caucasian. You know, so here, when we made the changes in the civil rights, it wasn't just because of, you know, us protesting and rioting, you know, because at the end of the day, we didn't have power. You have power, you know, in the politicians. We have to get out there and vote. You have to vote people in that are going to change policy. You know, we can have, it was so obvious. So we had this, we still have this crazy pandemic, the coronavirus. And now the whole world has been at a standstill. And I think because of that, and now you have Floyd, now all the people that were saying that anytime they see a situation like that, the African-American dude, he had to do something. He probably wasn't following procedure. You know, all you gotta do, if you get stopped, all you gotta do is follow, you know, what the cop says and nothing happens. That doesn't happen. You know, he was following, you know, so now I think everybody's being able to see that, you know, because that, you know, even if I watch it, man, it brings tears to my eyes. This dude called out his mom, whose mom was had passed 2 years. Can you imagine that? Can you be him, you know, for 10 seconds? Not 10 minutes, just for 10 seconds, you know, and you know, you understand that. And I think now a lot of people are getting it. Is everybody going to get it? No. We just have to have the majority to get it. So with that, now we have to demand changes. We have to demand that when an officer, you know, a police officer goes out and that police officer does something that's unjust, you know, that they're held accountable. So there has to be policy that if you do this, you're going to get not, you know, here, because right now we still don't know. They got arrested, but it's going to be anarchy if those guys get off, you know. So all this protest is all null and void if those guys get off. So, but then once you systemically try and change, you know, the police policies, you got to change the social policies, the political policies. It has to be where me as an African American, I can have a great business idea, you know, and I'm in a lower socioeconomic bracket, that somehow that these people can now start getting the loans, because loans have been given out to Caucasian businesses that were not as established as some African-Americans, business people that I know here in Cincinnati, Ohio, you know, have not been able to get loans, and that they have been in business, have a successful restaurant, have a successful nightclub, have a successful hair salon, a barbershop, but have not been able to. They've applied to certain banks, but they couldn't get that, you know, couldn't get the money. So here, when you look at and redlining, what banks did, you know, they wouldn't lend to people. So if I wanted to open up a barbershop, you know, in South Central Los Angeles, you're not going to lend the money to me because it's a lower socioeconomic area. So me giving money to you, I'm going to say no, I'm going to deny it. So systematically, if you look at that, and this is a race of people, not just in Los Angeles, not just in Cincinnati, it's throughout America. So when you have a system like that, that has to change, you know, but it's creating, it's the policy makers, you know. And
people have to vote. You know, you talk about invoking change, and our country is set up that the way we invoke change, as you said, the policy makers, and in order, so everybody has to assume that responsibility that we are given as Americans to go and vote. And I also think that I hear, Joe, I've had, you know, lots of conversations, as I'm sure you have and Mark has, is too many people rationalizing their feelings. And I think we have to step, and I'm talking about, you know, people like myself or Mark or others, that not the people that have been oppressed, that have to step back and humble themselves and they have to lose their ego, and they have to lose their struggle for control, and they have to sit quietly, and they have to listen, and they have to reflect, and they have to stop rationalizing their thoughts. Really, you know, Nick Saban used to use a comment to his team is get out of yourself and into the team. And I don't know how you'd say it, but get out of yourself and get into the feelings of others. And that's called empathy. And my concern, Joe, my biggest concern here is it's not the violence, as you said earlier. I like to believe, and I can't ever believe it at the depth that you can or understand, the violence. Because when we become passionate, we become emotional, we become enraged, violence is a natural reaction to that with most people. But my biggest concern, and what I want to make sure that, you know, I do all I can to promote, is how do we not just keep the conversation alive, but we need to, is how do we make sure that we make the progress that needs to be made? Because I think you can go back and you can look at some of the same pictures that were produced in 1963 of a black woman being stood on with the knee of a white cop. And you see the same image here in 2010.
Rodney King, Jim.
No. This is Mark. This is in the 60s.
I know what you're talking about. What I'm saying.
Rodney King, but there's
it keeps repeating yourself.
There has to be a call to action that doesn't end. This can't be another news cycle. You know, coronavirus, we don't even hear about the coronavirus now. Mm-hmm. And people don't even understand how it affected the African American, the Black American community, the African American community around the world. But you can't even find news on the coronavirus now. And it's still killing people. And maybe that's good, but we have to make sure that this moment in time does not escape our hand, it does not escape our minds, that we act on it and not just talk about it. And it's action. And Joe, help us, you know, and guide us. And I know, and you are.
Let me frame up the question. The bottom line is this, is that, you know, the net is this, is that we're going through this crazy time. And I do agree, Joe, that I think when Colin was taking a knee, I think too many of us were focused on the flag, like Drew Brees, and not what he was really trying to say. I don't know. Somewhere or another, the message got lost, at least to me. But now it
didn't get lost. People didn't listen.
They didn't get listened.
They want her. Colin Kaepernick was very clear that the reason that he was taking a knee was in protest to police brutality. And very clear, but people didn't want to hear that. You know, they thought he was disrespecting the flag. But the people that went and fought for the rights of Americans were fighting for the rights of people like Colin Kaepernick and Eric Reed to take a knee and say, this is not okay with me. It was in no way was it a condemnation of our flag or the people that had fought for our freedoms. It was in actuality, it was a celebration of those people that he had the ability to do so. And
so Joe, how do we elevate this? And as Jim was talking about, making sure that this doesn't get lost in the craziness and that there's actual real change. And I think that's one of the things you were focused on.
You know, we have to, first, like I said, get everybody to listen. You know, we can talk about here. Drew initially said that it was, his grandfather's fault in the wars. But guess what? There were a lot of African Americans that fought in those wars, and when they came back, they were spat upon. You know, they were hung. They were, you know, they weren't given the same treatment as your Caucasian veterans have. So, but my thing is, we have to get away from that narrative, because it's never been that. I think, I don't think 45, you know, he said it out loud to get that narrative going, that it was about the disrespect of the flag, and disrespecting veterans. And it was never that. Shout out to Nate Boyer, who what was disrespectful was Colin sitting down. Now this NFL veteran and Marine. I don't know if he was in Marines, but he told him to take a knee. So it was said that he couldn't. What would he know about, you know, million dollar athlete know about, you know, being oppressed? And here being a first round pick, you know, and being racially profiled and having, you know, guns put to my head at routine stops. We trying to understand and let everybody understand the plight of police brutality. And they don't have to have a reason. You've seen Caucasian kids, the Caucasian kid who went in and murdered nine wonderful African-Americans in the church in South Carolina. When they caught him, you know, they eventually got Burger King for him. You know, wasn't slammed to the ground, wasn't, you know, brutally maimed. And, you know, so that right there, first of all, the white America needs to understand not just, you know, because there's white supremacy, but that's those people way on the right that, you know, white privilege. You know, it is white privilege. Me being an African-American man, and I've you know, been in the elevator and being the only African-American man in their elevator, and I have to purposely try and make other white people on the elevator to feel comfortable because I don't want them to think that I'm this angry black man and they got to worry about, you know, getting robbed. You know, so that's ingrained. You know, that's not, you don't get on the elevator, neither, you know, Jimmy or Mark, you wouldn't get on the elevator. That wouldn't even come. You wouldn't even think about that. You know, here walking behind a white lady in the store, you know, I have to make sure that she knows I'm there so I don't frighten her. You know, these are the things, you know, telling your kids when the police stop, you put your hands at 10 and 2, you know. So it's first and I think, like I said, I think this thing is galvanizing and the white community understanding their white privilege and understanding what that means. Understanding when we're talking about Black Lives Matter, we're not saying that your life don't matter. My life is more important to than yours. You know, we want to be equal. We're not hollering because we want, you know, to be superior to you. We've been trying to fight for 40 years to say that we are your equal. You know, and we want to have equal access to housing. You know, we want to have equal access to jobs. You know, we're talking about here being able to open up a business, getting a bank loan, the judicial system. You know, talking about black on black crime. When black folks kill black folks, they go to jail for a long time. So it's working in that aspect, but it's not working when an African American is killed by the hands of a police officer. So I think, you know, you said it's getting out there and voting and just, we're just not voting for the president because the president only can do so much. You know, we got to get out there and we got to vote at the midterms. You know, your senators, you know, your congresspeople, the people that are putting the laws and the policies on the books. We have to do that. We, you know, there has to be a change. Not that we're going to do these things in the police department. We have to see change in the police department. You know, we have to, you know, whether or not that's better training. And you know, here you've been a police officer. That was not in your training manual what you did before. That wasn't in your training manual when you went to Breonna Taylor's house and kicked the door in and shot this baby eight times. That wasn't in your manual. So, you know, we have to. And I think when more people, enough people right now are listening. So here we can take this momentum of what we have. The election is coming up in November. You got to get out there. You want change? You got to get out there and vote. But we have to put pressure on the policymakers and so that they can invoke change, you know, in the banking system, you know, redlining, you know, this housing and affordable housing opportunity. It starts from a kid. You know, here when you're talking about here in the African American community, teachers are they're the lowest paid on a teacher over here where I live right now. This teacher might make 80,000-90,000, but that teacher that is teaching down in inner city in Cincinnati at Woodward High School or Taft High School, they're probably making $37,000, but guess what? They got to bring their own supplies. Sometimes they got to feed the kids that are at school. So, you know, here, when you're growing up in with an educational system that is so inferior to a school that's probably five minutes away. You know, and those kids, they have better teachers, they have better resources, they have better extracurricular activities. Where here, you know, babies that are coming to school in the inner city areas, you know, they're coming to school hungry. You know, the teachers are you have books. You know, my kids, because you know me, I've been doing group homes since I retired, and my kids they go to school, and you know the books they bring home, like, you know, they had that book in the 80s when I was in school. You know, so it starts there. It starts with, you know, the educational system and having, you know, having allowing it or somehow getting to a point where it's fair. So when I'm coming up, whether or not, you know, I'm from a one parent house. When I go to this school, the same opportunities that the kid over here, you know, in this white community has, the same type of teachers, somehow we got to get to where it's equal. You know, so when it's equal, we're not saying here, give us more money than them. Make it equal. You know, so we'll have the opportunities. You know, here, when you're talking about, you know, going through and becoming a senior in high school, you know, coming to senior high school, a lot of kids are not afforded the opportunity to go to college. You know why? Because of economics. Doesn't mean that I wasn't smart. I had a teacher, I had a counselor in Jefferson High School that told me, and I graduated with 3.2. So I was a pretty good student. That, you know, me going to college, he didn't know about me going from inner city Jefferson High School to University of Washington because somehow academically, you know, our schools are so inferior, you know, and I'm saying, well, hell, you know, algebra is algebra. Geometry is geometry. It's not a different geometry, but it's the low expectation because, you know, we don't have access to the same things that the other kids have. You know, and even when you graduate from college, you know, here, our parents didn't own the construction company. You know, they didn't own, they're not into banking. You know, here, a lot of times in the African-American community, you may have been the first one to go to college. You know, so here, you're talking about some of the things that African-American athletes, they're usually the first one to go to college, graduate from college, and now they have money. And now they're using their fortune to try and bring up, you know, the mom, the sister, the cousin, you know, whereas here, a lot of, you know, not the stereotype, but, you know, all the Caucasian guys that made the NFL, you know, came from affluent background, but, you know, had more opportunity. So, there's so much that needs to be fixed.
Yeah.
But it's only start with the listening. And I think that's where we are right now.
I think we're in that phase. I want to ask you something more personal now, and that is because I've never been arrested. I've never had a gun pointed at my head. You mentioned that it's happened to you. Well, you mentioned it twice, and you said it's happened five or six times.
Yes.
And Joe, tell me what that's like to be sitting in a car, right? And you get pulled over because your light or something's out, right? And next thing, rather than the police come up, and for me, they'd say, hey, let me get your license and your insurance, proof of insurance or something. Mm-hmm. And with you, you've got a gun to your head, right?
Yes.
Tell me what's going through your mind when that's happened, not once, not twice, not three times, four times. Yeah. Like what, like, how do you process that?
You know, it's funny because we all, you know, you guys talked about Fred Small. So Fred is the only reason I went to UW. You know, we went to rival high schools. Fred went to when he was my host, and I came to UW because of Fred. And ultimately, Fred is my daughter's godfather. But I would just so happen to come down and I was staying with Fred when I got drafted, and Fred was witnessed to it maybe three times. So here, and I didn't get stopped because of a taillight. I didn't get stopped for a moving violation. I got stopped because I fit the description. So one evening I'm driving and I have nice clothes on, you know, got a date. We're driving through Beverly Hills. And I'm driving, at this time I'm driving Fred's Porsche. He had a black Porsche. I don't know if you guys remember that little black Porsche he had.
Yeah.
I'm driving this Porsche and I see a police car get behind me, you know, so I'm at 10 and 2. I see another police car get behind me. I said, okay. So we're, you know, we got our seatbelts on, hadn't been drinking, you know, I'm on my way to the bar, but I haven't been drinking at that time. Next thing you know, I see a helicopter. Eventually, they turn the lights on me. It's raining. They tell me to roll the window down, you know, throw my keys out, you know, roll the window down, open the car up from the outside, get out, you know. So I have helicopters on me. I have police cars in front of me. I got police cars across the street, police cars in front of me. Every last one of them have their gun out, make me get out, put my hands behind my head, tell me to walk, you know, walk toward backwards toward their curb. And then one comes right up to me, tells me to get on the ground. And this time it's pouring rain. And I'm like, dude, it's pouring raining, man. And he put the gun right to my forehead, you know, and told me, get on the ground. So, you know, he had the gun to my head, so I got on the ground, you know. And eventually they went through the car, searched the car, you know, the glove compartment, didn't find anything. They said I fit the description of someone that just robbed a liquor store. They found out that I was playing for Cincinnati Bengals and had the audacity to ask me for my autograph. So, you know, my night was ruined. Another time, Fred and I'm with Fred and we're at a car, washing our cars. He gets his car washed before me. He leaves. I told him I'd meet him at the house. We seen the police across the street. And I'm thinking, nothing. We're not doing it. We're washing our cars. I get in my car. He gets right behind me. You know, I'm at 10-2, seatbelt on, put my blinker on. I drive maybe half a mile. He pulls me over, turns the light, pulls me over. You know, get out the car, you know, make me get out the car, you know, as his gun drawn. And I'm saying, dude, I seen you at the car wash. What you stopping me for? So initially he said he stopped me because I didn't put my blinker on. I don't know. The law says 65 feet, 35 feet. I don't know. But I put it on, what, 33 feet before I made a turn. Handcuffed me, put me on the ground, had the gun to my head, you know, all because I was suspicious. I was a young, you know, back then, you know, I was a stud muffin looking guy. Mark, you know, I used to look like baby.
Nah, you all good. You are, man.
So he stopped me, didn't give me a ticket, you know, but being handcuffed, you know, I never got a ticket. I was in front of Fred's house. The last story, I was in front of Fred's house, sitting in my car in front of Fred's house, not driving. Police come up. It's probably maybe 10 o'clock at night. Police come up, put the lights on me. You know, and I'm just at this time, this is maybe the fourth time. And I was only visiting Fred for a week. So I'm just saying, so I called Fred. I said, Fred, man, I am sitting out front of your house, and now there's two police cars harassing. So he comes out, they turn the light on him. So he comes out and he's like, you know, why are y'all effing with him? Right. So they put the gun on him and told him to get the hell in the house. You know, so again, they come in, make me get out the car, guns drawn. And I'm like, dude, I'm not even driving, you know, and of course I was upset. So, you know, I was, you know, I said, but it was just like, you know, what the hell, man? You know, so there's, you know, been so many times and the narrative is that, you know, here, that doesn't happen. I've never had one of my white teammates in NFL say, man, I was just driving and nothing. And police pulled me over and put a gun to my head. I've never heard that story.
Well, I'm one of them.
You know, and I can ask more than 50%, probably more like 70% of guys, African-American guys that I play with, if you got stopped for nothing and the guns are drawn. Even if I was speeding, what the hell are you putting your gun out for? Yeah. You know, so here you're pulling your gun out because of your preconceived ideas of who I am or what I'm like. You know, so, you know, it's, you know, I have so many personally, you know, just stories where being profiled. One last story. I was in my home, you know, bought a home, 6,500 square feet, swimming pool. So I'm out doing my yard. So I, you know, I don't have like Joe's landscaping on. I'm just doing my yard. I'm, you know, picking weeds and, you know, doing some mulch. So white guy comes up, pulls up in my driveway. And, you know, I'm looking at him, you know, saying, thinking that he's going to acknowledge me, like, hey, what's going on? And he walked right past me. So at this time, I'm kind of like laughing. He goes to my front door, rings the doorbell. So now I'm just kind of like, okay, you know, so I keep on doing my yard work. He goes, walks right past me, goes by toward the edge of my backyard and looking, you know, looking at the pool. So I don't know if I think my kids are out there or something. So at this time, so now I'm kind of pissed, right? So he walks up to me, back up to me, and he said, hey, so can you tell me when the owner of the house is going to be here? And, you know, dude, I'm like in some basketball shorts and, you know, and I'm saying, well, dude, I'm the owner, you know, and he was trying to sell something. And, you know, I had some choice words for him, you know, and, you know, get them off my property before I beat you. You know what I mean? Because you walk right past me, dude. Then you walked in my backyard. You know, you didn't acknowledge me at all. You know, so, you know, it's that wasn't because of, you know, I'm sure if I was a Caucasian dude, you at least would have said, hey, buddy, you know, hey, I'm selling this or whatever. But, you know, it's there's 8 trillion stories like that.
Well, that's what with you. So I think Jim want to jump in here and ask you another question. Jim, you want to jump in?
Well, I want to just make a comment first that hearing the firsthand accounts that you're relaying to people and to us, and hopefully through us to people, is what people needs to hear. Because it's, a lot of times if people say, I had a buddy that this happened to, and Joe, it actually happened to you. And so it resonates much, much stronger. I also want to mention that, you know, Mark and I had the great pleasure of climbing Mount Kilimanjaro with Nate Boyer, who was a Green Beret, who did have the conversation with Colin about taking a knee rather than sitting on the bench as a sign of respect for the flag, and yet also using as a way to protest police brutality. I wish people could listen to what he says. And then 2 other things I'd encourage people to do that, you know, 2 things that have been powerful to me in the last few days was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar wrote a tremendous op-ed in the LA Times. I believe it was yesterday. And I think that, you know, white America needs to read that. And then my broadcast partner, and maybe you've seen this, Joe, his name's Emmanuel Acho, and he was a linebacker at Texas, played in the league for a little bit. His brother, Sam Acho, played. Emmanuel and I have sat next to each other for every college football week in the last 2 years. And he did a video the other day on his Twitter. And it's got, I believe, 6 million views right now. And he's really talking to his white friends and what they can do. And I think people should watch that as well. He's at the man Acho on Twitter. I think these are really compelling things to do. But, you know, as a human, I'm encouraged, you know, as I see the rally of people that and the people that are making their voices heard, but I'm not convinced. And that's my biggest fear, as I said before, is just keeping it alive. And I think, Joe, you're so passionate and you're so compelling and you have firsthand accounts and you are relevant. And I hope that people can listen to you, and I hope you can continue to find a way to get your experiences out to people. I think it's really interesting that, you know, I think when people think, and this is, you know, Joe, I've recruited, you know, every high school in LA. I've been into, they call it Jefferson High School now. I kind of dropped the Thomas, but yeah. I've been into school. You know, I've been into Freddie's school. And I think that people should also know this Fred Small that you're talking about was in law enforcement. You know,
police officer. Yeah.
When I think about your high school and some of the people that have come out of there, you know, Woody Strode, who was one of the 2 African-Americans that broke the color barrier in the NFL. And Ralph Bunch, who in 1950 was the first African-American who won the Nobel Peace Prize, you know.
And Jefferson High School. Yeah. A bunch.
Yeah. And Samuel Brown, the musician. I mean, and so, you know, you come from a background of experience and of people overcoming, and your words are so, they're so profound, you know. I appreciate this time that I've gotten to listen to you. And then another thing, I think for anyone, you know, we've talked about a little bit Black Lives Matter, and then this concept of All Lives Matter. And I think that we'll all concede that, yeah, all lives matter. But right now, at this point in our history, Black Lives Matter. And you know Roman Pfeiffer, who was my actually director of player development at UCLA, and then when he left. You remember Deshaun Foster, the great running back? Deshaun sent me 2, or I saw 2 of his things that he said the other day, and he's talking about white privilege. And he said, here's an example of how white privilege sounds. You keep saying, quote, it's horrible that an innocent black man was killed, but destroying property has to stop, as opposed to saying it's horrible that property is being destroyed, but killing innocent black men has to stop. It's about what you prioritize.
Yeah.
And then with regards to these people that say, yeah, Black Lives Matter, but all lives matter. Now's not the time to say that.
Yes.
It's once again, to me, it's a rationalization. And this way, sense saying all lives matter as a response to Black Lives Matter is like saying the fire department should spray down all houses in a neighborhood, even though only one house is on fire.
Right.
Because all houses matter. Right. Yeah. Right. But your house matters too, but our house is on fire.
It's on fire.
You know, heard that, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. The plight of the African American, you know, it's on fire.
Yeah.
You know, so that's what we're saying. It's on fire right now, and it needs to be extinguished.
You need more ways to get your voice heard, my man. You're so compelling and so passionate and so even keeled in your ability to make your observations known. I love it.
Yeah, I appreciate you know, you my teammates, man. I love both of you guys, man. You know, rooted for, you know, you both of you guys, man, and love when you became an NFL coach, Jimmy, and you know, supported you, man, and proud to call both of you guys, you know, my brothers, man.
So we got a quick shout out from Jim Simpson. He and Rick Finney are walking on the way to Mount Rushmore. Way to go, guys!
Oh, wow. Way to go, guys! Yeah,
yeah.
So we are teammates, man. It's you know, you have that, man, and you think about all the guys that, you know, here we're 30 years later, man. It's you know, brothers, man, and you know, looking out for guys, man. And I seen you know, my Facebook, Ronnie Miles, he had tuned in, and you know, Ronnie's, you know, doing a great thing, been down there in San Diego Chargers DB coach. So we have so many of our guys. If we can give the world what we had in the locker room, oh my God.
Yeah.
It's in that locker room, man. And there's every race, there's every social and economic status in that locker room. And you put that together, man. And you know, it's magic, you know, and you know, and unfortunately everybody can't experience that, but I can tell you every athlete that's was able to get there. We could bottle that up and sell it and put it out there for the world, not just America, the world to see. But like you said, we have to take this momentum that we have. And I think we have enough people, you know, there's, I'm not trying to convince that guy that's so far over there. It doesn't matter what I say, you know, you're going to have that just like, you know, guys way over to the left. You know, so I think right now we have enough people to invoke change, you know, like with the civil rights. We have enough people, but things are more galvanized now. If you can imagine with Martin Luther King and what he was doing, you know, and being beat and thrown in jail, you know, that was in, you know, here are some of the major cities in America. This right now is throughout the world. This is throughout the world. You know, so everybody is seeing it. Everybody is looking at that video and saying, you know, if you looked at that video and you had any compassion for human life, you looked at that and now I get it. And there are so many people now that saying, I get it. Look, I get it. Look at that. You know, and this grown man is calling out and crying for his mother, his dead mother, man. You know, and I get it. You know, but I don't give a damn. If you're getting it right now, you get it. You know, so now, like I said, now I think those people, we got to talk about this, keep this thing going, you know, to the primaries, you know, and in Iowa, they had a primary, I think, on Tuesday. And one of the congressmen that was very, very, had very racist views was finally voted out after 18 years. This happened on Tuesday, you know, so that doesn't happen, you know, without this Floyd. This thing that what he's been, you know, unfortunately, his losing his life has galvanized, because that guy's been a congressman for 18 years. He just got voted out, you know, and he Trump supported him, you know. So here people are seeing, you know, people are listening, you know, they're listening. So now, you know, we have to take and get this momentum, and we have to be this passionate when the primaries come around. We have to be this passionate when in November, when the election is, you know. And to me, this is not about Republican or Democratic, you know, because I respectfully, you know, agree with everybody's position, you know, and we just have philosophical differences how we get to the same, but we have the same belief. We can work and get to where we want to go. But when you have somebody as divisive as this guy is, you know, Trump is speaking of, you know, it can hinder, you know, some of this momentum that we need to have. And you know, the plight is just here, man. We, you know, African-American community just wants what's fair. We want what's equal, you know. So if, you know, Mark Patterson, Joe Kelly, and Jimmy Moore are equal, and we both have, you know, a degree from the University of Washington, and we go apply for the job, you know, that I can get it, because, you know, even if my name is Joe, or if my name, you know, if my name was Muhammad, you know, that person that's looking, that personnel person that's looking at our resumes does not, you know, discriminate against me because of the color of my skin or my name or what have you. You know, we all are, it's an equal playing field. You know, and it's are we going to get there tomorrow? No, but we're you have to start somewhere, you know.
Joe, so you bring up a tremendous point, and I don't know if you saw what Vic Fangio, the head coach of the Denver Broncos, said the other day, where he doesn't see racism in the NFL and that it's a meritocracy. Yes. And on the field, for the players, I would agree to such extent that it is a meritocracy. You earn what you get. But that's not the NFL. That's not the only part of the NFL. And if you look at the inequities at the levels of assistant coaches, head coaches, general managers, director of player personnel, presidents, ownership, the inequities are staggering. They're staggering. And I would attribute that to a number of things, and probably most profoundly, what we're talking about here, you know, this racial injustice. I spent 25 years in the National Football League, and I worked very hard to get where I was. But I'd be ignorant to think that, number one, my name, and number one, my skin color did not help me in many, many, many ways, because I worked with some tremendous, tremendous people that just didn't get the opportunities that I got because of built-in discriminations against them. And so, you know, I think Vic, he was able to walk back his comments, and I don't know that he understood. He was talking about the players on the field as opposed to management, but that is the NFL. And you talk about the huddle, Joe, or you talk about the locker room or the huddle, and that ability of people from all ethnic backgrounds, socioeconomic backgrounds, religious backgrounds, parts of the country being able to come together, and that nobody huddles anymore, but the concept of the huddle. And oftentimes we would hold hands and somebody would call out a defense, or they would call out a play. And every single one of us was dependent on the other to execute that play so that we could have success. And if we could find a way to take, as you said, that concept and produce it in our society, where you were able to look beyond some of the differences that were taught to you as you grew up and recognize that in order for us to succeed on that play or in that game or as a society, we need to be able to join hands with those that look or believe a little bit differently than us, okay, and do the right thing so that we can all have success. And
absolutely.
You know, Steve Young had a great thing about the huddle, you know, and it's just, you're right. You said, Joe, you've said so many incredibly profound and enlightening things today. I hope that somehow the world gets a chance to listen to what you are saying. You know, I haven't talked to you in years, but that smile, you know, when I think of Joe Kelly, I think of a smile and I think of hope. And Joe, you give hope. You give me hope. You know, I mean, I just remember 36, a smile and a flat out, you know, sucker player, man. But I also think of this.
Hey, you never got hit by Jim. You never got hit by Joe Kelly. I did.
Well, I think that, no, I'm going to say this.
He was a badass, dude.
You know, my senior year, I had to go play linebacker. So I had to do like those butt drills with him. Remember that?
Butt drills.
I was about $1.95, and I was, you know, I ran down on some kickoffs, and I think I took some hits, you know, but probably not like you. But then again, you know, I blasted you a couple times too. Right. But anyway, I just think that you make sense, man. You're awesome, and I appreciate you. I really appreciate you,
man. I appreciate Mark, you having me on, and. You know, Jimmy, you coming on, man, and, you know, all of us, man, being able to, you know, share our views, you know, me listening, you know, you listening, you know, and really all of us hearing or trying to hear what the other person is saying. Like I said, it's, you know, we can't, African-American community can no way do this by themselves, you know, systemically, because this is something, this has been part of our society, you know, since the beginning, before slavery. So, you know, it isn't changed overnight. You would think that, you know, after Martin Luther King and the civil rights, that we wouldn't be discussing. We wouldn't be discussing that, what happened to Floyd. That should be so far from reality. But that's our reality, you know. So it was nothing for me to hear my uncles talk about here, you know, not walking over here or getting caught after dark or police, you know, beating you up. You know, that was every day, you know, here, you know, the trauma. You have to understand how many kids we're looking at, and you know, they're going off on a lot of these young kids that are out there, you know, and tearing things up. You have to understand that the trauma that kids in lower socioeconomic areas growing up, you know, here, growing up, imagine growing up and you don't know what dinner is. You know, we got to come home and it's eviction notice. You know, about the time I'm five, mom moved 17 times. You know, you look at all these things that you know, here you're coming out and you know, Freddie and I growing up in South Central Los Angeles, you know, and hearing the helicopter, you know, and the drive-bys, you know, and you know, you got kids at 8, 9 years old that have witnessed murders, witnessed people getting shot, you know, and when a baby can become immune to that, you know, or that lifestyle, or seeing, you know, here the you know, the drug dealing, and you know, hey, all these drugs in the African American community. No, they're in the white community as well, you know. But when you look at you know, here, when we're talking about, you know, illegal drugs, there aren't any poppy fields in South Central Los Angeles. They're not, you know, 200 acres of marijuana growing in the middle of South Central Los Angeles. That's getting imported in. You know, you don't have African Americans that have own airlines, you know, and flying this stuff in, you know, own yachts and bringing it over, you know. So here, when that stuff is in, you're talking about here, you know, the thing is, people have to understand, I'm not looking for an excuse, you know, it's survival. I'm trying to survive, you know. We're trying to eat, you know. I'm trying to, you know, not be getting evicted, you know, and since I retired. And I started Kelly Youth Services, and I you know, I own group homes here in Cincinnati, and that's my population. You know, my population, you know, is lower socioeconomic kids are in abused, at risk situations. You know, and you know, been gone for 22 years, but I can tell you, the last 3 years, I've had more Caucasian kids in the last 3 years than the previous 18, 19 years combined. And that's because the opioid situation has affected the Caucasian race a lot more than in Hamilton, Ohio is the number one. Hamilton, Ohio, a little north of Cincinnati, Ohio, one of the number one area for opioid abuse. Hamilton, Ohio, suburb of Cincinnati. So you're talking about here how the Caucasian race in throughout America is getting decimated because of, you know, opioids, you know, and what's going on with them, you know, I see it firsthand because I'm getting those kids. But this is what happened to the African-American community when we're talking about crack in the early 80s. It affected the African-American community. So, you know, here, when we look at, you know, we have the dialogue that we can hear and listen to each other. We know we have so much in common. It's ridiculous. You know, if we stop trying to say who's more superior or inferior, you know, and, you know, we all have an opportunity, and the opportunity starts at birth. You know, so if this kid, if he's born into the situation and he doesn't even have an opportunity, you know, inferior schools, you know, inferior education system, you know, you have the police brutality, you know, the social injustices. This is how he grows up, you know, and I don't have the opportunity to if I don't get a football scholarship, you know, mom damn sure can't send me to UCLA. So, you know, if those opportunities, imagine, you know, how fair, you know, it would be, you know, if everybody was afforded those opportunities, you know, and a lot of, you know, majority of us are born into situations, you know, all of us are born in situations we have no control over. But, you know, it's being afforded the opportunity, you know, and then you can fairly judge a person based on the opportunity that they had. And right now, that is not the case with the African-American community. So, you know, definitely, you know, the halls of social justice, you know, the political picture, you know, that has to change. And that change is going to come with not just me. It's going to come with guys like you that also have a platform, Caucasian guys that, you know, that people listen to. And, you know, I can get, because you have some guys that are so, no, he's disrespecting the flag. I don't care what you say, Jimmy. He just, you know, let me try to explain. You know, and here, you know, it's just that it's dialogue. You have to have dialogue, and this dialogue has to continue beyond once Floyd is buried. And, you know, that's the only way we're going to invoke change. Well,
I think, Joe, that we're transitioning in the way that what's gone on. I really feel like, you know, like my entire, I'm 58 years old now, as is Jim. He's a few years older than me. And we're all about the same age, right? And it just feels like there, between the coronavirus, which has nothing to do with this, but it did make the world, you know, slow down, which is this like transition into this horrific event, which has domino affected all these other events that have been going on. And it doesn't look like it's stopping. I mean, every night, and like you said, I'm living in this small town, Sun Valley, Idaho, in the middle of nowhere. And there was 300 people up on the street with signs, Black Lives Matter, the other night, right? Everybody up there is white, right?
That's amazing, man.
And I would have never said, like, that could have happened. And there, so it is affecting change. And it just seems like the next step is then making sure that, as Jim mentioned about 45 minutes ago, making sure that scab doesn't come off, right? Or it does come off. You know,
right, yeah. It's not time yet, you know?
No, but what I'm saying is that it's just why the iron is hot, to seize on the moment, to make sure that we do get to this equality standpoint Joe has been hammering since, you know, he came on the pod. So, Joe, let me say this as we kind of round third base here. We can literally, we're old teammates, we're old friends. Love ya. You, I'm so glad I was compelled last week to, like, I need to get somebody on the pod that isn't white, that speaks what's really going on out there, that I can better understand, I can learn, share my form. I know Jim was really compelled to come on and talk to you, beyond just the fact that we all haven't gathered in many years. It feels like yesterday, really, you know, having this conversation, not the topic, but just, you know, brothers coming together for a common cause and trying to solve something. And in some small little way, I hope that we accomplish that today. With whoever this touches, it just only has to touch one. It certainly touched me. I think it's touched Jim. And we're going to run this pod, by the way, for anybody that's listening out there right now. I've seen the numbers have been pretty high. And this will run on all my channels in perpetuity. And then we're going to run this as a podcast probably next week, Joe, so we can get the word again to even a larger audience. So that's exciting to me. So on that note, Jim, thank you so much for coming on. Joe, you're amazing. You're so well spoken, and you're the way that you articulate the position and what's going on out there. And then the most compelling thing to me was that these experiences that you were talking today about, having guns at your head and having to kneel down multiple times. And I can't, you know, I'm on behalf of white people, I'm sorry that, you know, that happened, because it should have never happened to you, nor all the other injustices that are happening out there. So I hope this will create real change.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate you having me on, man. And like I said, it's you know, great for you brothers, man, to keep this thing going, man. And you know, keeping the dialogue going. And you know, here we're you know, all we're scattered over. I'm in Ohio, you're in Idaho, Jimmy's down in Cali. So, you know, here, but it's our circle. You know, we can, as one, we can all effectively try and change our circle. You know, and our circle and your circle, you know, my circle is beyond just my African-American friends. You know, my circle are my Caucasian friends. You know, my platform, whether or not it's Facebook, you know, if I'm down, you know, sit down and we've talked to our the kids in the group home, about what's going on, to let them understand. And, you know, they want to loot, they want to tear stuff up, and just try and get them to understand what's going on. It's not just about going out there and looting and tearing stuff up. But this is what it's about. And, you know, touching and trying to touch on all the aspects, because there's so much. And like I said, change is not going to come overnight. Thank God these four guys are going to be held accountable initially. So down the judicial system, you know, has to, if these four guys get off, then it doesn't matter. This galvanization that has happened, it could be all for naught. And I think where it is now, if you can, and we're old enough to remember what was going on in the civil rights with Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, that this movement right now is bigger than that. Imagine, it's bigger than that. That's crazy. It's bigger than that. From a guy that nobody knew, you know, but Steven Jackson, you know, the NBA player, that was his, you know, it was his twin, you know, but this guy has now galvanized the world, you know. So it's an unfortunate incident, but man, damn, this is good, man. This is good. What's going on? It's, you see it, you know, it's like 84 team. We knew when we said NT. Remember the spring ball? We're talking NT, National Title. We knew it was something special. Damn it, it was something special. You know what I mean? And I'm getting chills right now just thinking about, you know, what we had special. We knew it. You know, we kept that momentum going, you know, and that led us all the way to the Orange Bowl and kicking Oklahoma's ass. You know, so this is what we have to take. We have to take this momentum, and we have to invoke change. We have to be vocal. You guys have to be vocal. Other Caucasian people have to be vocal. You look at these marches and protests, 50% Caucasian, you know, and we only can get there because we can't invoke change. We can holler all we want, but if we're not voting, you know, and if you guys are not assisting with the voting, and we're not voting in the primaries, you know, and getting people in positions, you know, to invoke change, to invoke fairness. You know, we're not trying to tip the halls of, you know, we're trying to say, here, put this thing on a level scale, man. You know, that's it. That's it. You know, if you commit a crime, you know, here, if I steal and shoot Billy and I get 10 years, you shoot Bobby, you get 10.
Yeah.
You know, it's that. So, you know, I think where we are, I think it's still, you know, people still don't think it's changed because, you know, police have been charged before initially, but once they got to the judicial system, they were let off. So, you know, we're just hoping that, you know, here, this thing takes its course. And,
here's my pledge, Joe. I'm going to take my circle. Jim's going to take his circle. You're going to take your circle.
Absolutely.
We're going to have the same common cause. Yes. And let's go effect change, all right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much. Again, Jim Mora, Joe Kelly, you're amazing. And, you know, we're going to keep playing this and keep spreading the news. Thank you. All right, guys. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, guys. Love you, man.
Love you.
Love you, bro.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.
Over two centuries ago, it was England that taxed our tea. Now it's Brussels trying to regulate our companies. Under new European regulations, American businesses face crushing fines, forced disclosures, and foreign red tape that kills jobs here at home. America's laws should be written in America, not Brussels. Reject European regulatory overreach and uphold Trump's trade deal. Paid for by Americans for Limited Government.